COVID-19 is continuing to spread, but the way various cities and states are handling the crisis looks drastically different.
The thing here is this is like nothing we've ever experienced before.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and for The Takeaway for Wednesday, April 22nd, we speak with San Francisco Mayor London Breed on how her city is dealing with the pandemic and the most vulnerable populations. Also, a look at the Trump administration's heightened immigration restrictions.
When there's been some serious economic downturns, the United States ramped up its deportation.
Then the intersection between dangerous disinformation on COVID-19 and disinformation on climate change. And we round out the show with a big conversation on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day.
COVID-19 would have killed Earth Day in 1970. It's a really important speed bump in 2020.
All right, let's get going. We've been talking a lot on this show about state and local leaders, those who've been leading the charge against COVID-19 against the backdrop of a disorganized and uneven federal response. And we've been hearing directly from governors and mayors across the country. Today, we head to San Francisco, where Mayor London Breed has been met with praise for early interventions against the spread of COVID-19, as well as criticism for her handling of the virus among the city's large homeless population. Mayor Breed joins us now to talk about all of this. Welcome to the show.
Of course. Thank you.
Before we get too deep into this, how are you holding up?
Well, I'm surviving. It's definitely been very challenging not to resume my normal life, but everyone's in the same boat. And ultimately, this is really about trying to keep everyone safe.
Your city was one of the first big cities in the U.S. to take action against the coronavirus pretty early, March 16th. Tell me about why.
Well, we declared a state of emergency on February 25th of this year when we had not one case diagnosed, but we knew it wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when, and we had to be prepared. And so as we started to ramp up and communicate to the public what was going on, we started to eliminate large-scale events, and people continued to gather. And we were concerned about what that would mean if we continued to allow that to occur. So I think part of the reason why the decision was made is because we did a lot of work ahead of time to get people prepared for what we felt was the inevitable. And that is ultimately what we had to do on March 16th, and to ask everyone to remain at home, if at all possible, unless you're an essential worker for the city. So I think by the time we did that, especially because we did the state of emergency in February and we were communicating with the public on a regular basis about preparing and getting medications, and in some cases asking our elderly residents and those with disabilities and underlying health conditions to stay at home, people were ready when it hit.
You did get some pushback. Did you ever second guess yourself?
I definitely got some pushback, and I didn't second guess the need to do the decision because I knew what was at stake, and there was no question. But I did feel really bad for our small businesses, for our hotels and our restaurants, and the people that I knew would financially suffer as a result of this. I knew that this was going to have a devastating impact on our economy. Chinatown was already feeling the impacts because people were making certain assumptions because of xenophobia and a number of other challenges with our Chinese community. And so definitely I felt, you know, sadness about what I knew I had to do, but there was never even a question of whether or not I had to do it. Public health was at stake.
San Francisco is a city that is used to earthquakes and preparing for them. I guess I wonder if people there are maybe more primed to listen to public officials than you might have in a city that's not used to disasters.
Well, I think so, because we're a major city and we talk about preparedness, resiliency. We have a outreach team of people who we go and we have block parties and we talk about earthquakes. We talk about things that could potentially happen where we would need to survive on our own. We have created information about the things you need to keep at home, 72sf.org, which is a list of items that you should have just in case there's an earthquake. And so I think that might be part of it. That we are always thinking that it's not a matter of if, but it's a matter of when an earthquake might strike or when we might be the victims of a terrorist attack or what have you. These are simulations that we've practiced in our Department of Emergency Management. So we have systems in place like the wildfires and the air quality and the heat waves and other things that have occurred in the city where we've had to make certain adjustments. But ultimately, I think what has been extremely helpful is communicating from day one with the public about exactly what is going on when you have the facts. And I think that people, although they may not be happy about it or they may have some certain disagreements, they comply because they know that it's necessary. So I think that part of it is, yes, our history of earthquakes and other challenges, but also the communication strategy around communicating with the public early on about what's happening really, I think, had a lot to do with helping them get prepared for where we are now.
You've just announced that the city is going to start closing some streets to cars to encourage social distancing. Do you think that could make things harder for essential workers, especially since mass transit options in the city have been cut back? And I guess, how do you account for that? People still do need to get around if they're essential.
Listen, I think part of the thing here is this is like nothing we've ever experienced before. And ultimately, we want to protect public health, but we also want to protect mental health and public safety. And part of what we want people to do is, of course, stay indoors, but people need fresh air and they need to get out. And we want to make sure that they're safe in doing so. And so the goal is to try this out, to see how it works, and to make the necessary adjustments if there are challenges. Because at this point, you know, with the weather changing, people are going to be outside. And we want to make sure that there's room for people to distance themselves from one another safely. And so that's really what this is all about. And if we see that there are challenges, we will make adjustments.
I want to look at homelessness in your city, a big issue in San Francisco. At least 106 people, including 10 staff, got coronavirus in San Francisco's biggest shelter. And the spread of COVID has been a big problem across the homeless population. There were warnings before things got bad. Could you have done more to stop the spread?
I think that you could always do more to stop the spread of the virus. But the challenge that we run into is this is, you know, in the age of social distancing, where we have people who are not coming to work because they have to take care of their children or they have to take care of an aging parent, or they're just fearful of what might occur, especially with a very challenging population to begin with. We've actually in San Francisco housed almost 1,000 people in hotel rooms so far. We only have 5% of the homeless population in the state of California. But of the hotel rooms that we've been able to acquire, we have basically housed 25% of the homeless population that has been housed so far in this entire state. And so I think that says a lot about the system we put in place. But more importantly, the challenges of mental illness and substance use disorder don't just go away because there's a pandemic. These are people who, in some cases, the challenges we've run into in these shelters, not complying with the social distancing, even after we've helped to thin out the shelters so that there's more room, wearing a mask and wearing the gloves with the things that we provided, the hand sanitizer. We have regular cleanings. I invested early on $5 million into cleaning the shelters on a regular basis. And I think the challenges and where the staff even was frustrated in some instances, they're serving food to folks, they're helping people, they're social workers, but they're asking people to comply with something that doesn't always work with this population. And so I think that we're not taking into account the difficulties there and the difficulties in logistics in not only moving people to hotel locations, but trying to keep them there and trying to make sure that we increase our capacity by bringing in city workforce. Disaster service workers are, every city employee is a disaster service worker. And when we make those calls, we have over 30% of our city workforce saying no, because they're not necessarily comfortable with those jobs or for the other reasons I mentioned about taking care of their kids or a family member at home and being concerned about their health and well-being. And so this is the age of social distancing. And I think that it's a lot more challenging, not just for San Francisco, but for anyone with a large homeless population. So to expect us to all of a sudden open up every hotel room and have the ability to take care and house this group of people and things would get better is not necessarily realistic.
Why not do universal testing in the shelters, though? That's something that one of the San Francisco supervisors has suggested as a way to have a broader sense of where the virus stands in that population.
Again, not realistic. We are already experiencing a shortage with testing where, unfortunately, we are in a position where we can only test people who exhibit symptoms. And we are doing contact tracing so that we can start to test more people like we did with the shelter in this case. We brought in an operation to actually test people in this shelter, but what we had also were people who, after we asked them to stay and wait for the results, they left the shelter. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, even if we test everyone, then the next day, depending on what kind of contact they've had with someone, they could get the coronavirus right away. That doesn't solve the problem. Again, we're talking about a population in many instances that are not following the directions that we're giving them in order to keep them safe and the staff that's trying to serve them safe. So it's just not realistic. It sounds good, and wouldn't we want everyone to be tested? But the shortages that not only exist in San Francisco, but in the entire United States is not something that's necessarily within our control.
Yeah, California has been sort of lagging behind a lot of other states when it comes to testing, according to data from the COVID Tracking Project. Do you know why that is?
I don't completely understand why we have ordered. I think maybe has something to do with everybody in the U.S. is ordering the same thing. We're all looking for ventilators. We're all looking for swabs. We can run the test easily. We have the capacity to run a number of tests, but there's the swabs that are challenging to access. And I think that, you know, the challenges with what we're experiencing is not unique to San Francisco. It's happening all over the country. And the lack of coordination from the federal government to help assist cities, especially large cities that experience these challenges, is really what I think one of the problems is with in terms of access to these tests. But I also want to be clear that we've come a long way. We are able to test anyone who exhibits symptoms right away and provide test results within a day or two. We've come a long way from where we were before, where we hardly had access to anything. And we are doing everything we can to make sure that that's taken place. And now with contact tracing, our goal is to test people who don't exhibit symptoms, but who have had some level of contact with a person who has tested positive. That's going to be important as we look at reopening cities and trying to basically keep a lid on this virus. But we also definitely need more test kits.
Speaking of the future, San Francisco is expected to face a $1.7 billion budget shortfall because of COVID-19, which means you're going to have some very tough choices facing you. How will you address those revenue losses in the budget?
Well, a few weeks ago, I announced an economic recovery task force, which involves city elected officials, labor, the business community, and others to begin the process of preparing for what happens after we start to gradually reopen our doors. Because, for example, when we think about our restaurants and what might happen, new guidelines that may be implemented, what will that mean for their ability to pay their rent, to pay their staff, to bring back all their staff, and also their overall overhead? Is it going to be more expensive for them to do business? And what do we need to do as a city to support that? And what does that mean to the revenue that we generate? And also tourism, which is a huge industry in our city. What does this mean for the revenue that we're able to generate? We have to start planning for that sooner rather than later. And we're going to have to, unfortunately, make some hard choices in this process, because this is like nothing we've ever experienced before. But again, it's not unique to San Francisco. The entire economy in the United States is going to be tremendously impacted as a result of this virus. Not to mention the dollars that we won't be reimbursed for from the federal government for all the money that we're already spending for our business community, but also in order to maintain and manage this pandemic. The cost of what we're spending for PPE and all of those other things play a role into the challenges that I know we're going to face. But I also am hopeful about the future, and we're going to have to make some adjustments so that we are able to bring our economy back. And it's going to take a lot of patience. It's going to be a lot of heartache, and it's going to take some time.
Finally, Mayor Breed, you launched the city's first Office of Racial Equity last year. And looking at the data, we can see 25% of positive cases in San Francisco are among Latinos, though they make up only 15% of the San Francisco population. I wonder how you plan to use that office to address some of the COVID-19 related inequities that we're starting to see across your city and across the country.
Well, I think that part of what's important is that from the day one, our Emergency Operations Center has incorporated the Office of Racial Equity into the decisions that we made for outreach to communities that usually are disenfranchised. And so part of what we are doing is continuing to work with these communities to encourage them to get testing. And also, we have to remember that in many cases, not only are these folks serving as essential workers, but in some cases, they have to be able to find work in order to take care of their families, or they're living in congregate living settings, or they're living in households with a large number of people. And so we see that the inequities that exist in our society, where, you know, oftentimes the poor are more impacted in a negative way, especially when there's a pandemic. This is what we're seeing play itself out, not just in San Francisco, again, but all over the country. And part of what we have to continue to do, and what I'm proud that we are doing with our Office of Racial Equity and the Human Rights Commission, is our deliberate investment in providing food, in providing masks, in providing health care, free testing, whether you have health care or not, and providing support to people who do not have health care, and reaching out to those communities and providing hotel rooms in order to make sure that, for example, if you're in a congregate living and no one else tests positive but you test positive, we can move you into a room and make sure that you don't infect your other family members. So there are a number of things that we're doing here in the city in order to address the inequities that exist, and we're going to keep doing it.
Mayor Breed, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
London Breed is the mayor of San Francisco, California. In the middle of this pandemic, there's a lot of questionable information flying around. And with social media rife with fake science and confusing warnings, corporations, media outlets, and even government officials are capitalizing on the uncertainty. But this is hardly the first time that casting doubt on science has been used to spread fear and disinformation. In fact, experts say that decades of undermining science related to pollution and climate change has paved the way for COVID-19 denial. Recent data from private research firm Unicast shows that in places where people are less likely to believe climate change is real, people are also less likely to have engaged in social distancing and other behavior changes related to COVID-19. To look at all of this, I spoke with Jerry Taylor, president of the Niskanen Center, a nonpartisan policy think tank and a former climate skeptic, along with Amy Westervelt, editor-in-chief of Drilled News, who's looked at how the strategies for disinformation are similar for climate change and the response to COVID-19. I first asked Jerry why denial of COVID-19 feels like a deja vu for climate denial.
Well, for 23 years, I was in the climate skeptic business before I changed my mind, so I know that world reasonably well. And the arguments we're hearing underplaying the danger from COVID-19, challenging the body counts, complaints about the errant estimates with regards to the danger of becoming infected are the exact same kind of arguments you hear offered against climate action. They're often offered by the exact same people, as if there's a new business line for climate denialists, and now they run into the COVID denialist business. And it's anchoring in the same sort of psychological buttons that are being pressed. Lots of narratives about conspiracy, lots of people complaining about the technocratic elites who have nefarious agendas on hand. It's the exact same wine in a slightly new and refreshed bottle.
Amy, can you take us through some data in terms of how different studies have been used to deny science, for example?
It's more qualitative than quantitative, I would say. There's sort of very specific types of talking points that you see over and over again in science denial writ large.
Can you give me some examples of phrasing or ways of presenting some of this information that you think have caught on?
It's just a bad flu stories that, you know, you started to hear early on, and now people are reverting back to and questioning the authority of whoever's saying that social distancing works and questioning models and, you know, in general, using some of the ways that scientists speak and the way that science research works to question it. And this happens in climate science too. You know, there's uncertainty baked into science. It's how scientists talk. It's part of how science research funding happens too. You know, you never read a study that doesn't end with more research is needed, because that's kind of how researchers get their next grant. So it's really easy for a skeptic to come in, or someone who wants to sort of deliberately create doubt and confusion and say, look, the scientists aren't even sure about how this is happening. Or look, models, you know, which again, the way that models work is they include lots of different variables and they include extremes. And there are definitely valid critiques to be made of how modeling works, but pointing to the most extreme possibility and saying, this is ridiculous, therefore we should scrap all models and not believe scientists is like, it's a bit ridiculous, but it's a tactic that gets used over and over.
Jerry, tell me a little bit about what kinds of work you did in the past and what insight you feel like that gives you into this moment where, as you say, climate deniers are approaching COVID-19 with a similar playbook.
Well, a lot of it is just the psychology of this. I mean, after all, if there is a market demand for something, someone's going to produce the supply. There is a market demand right now for COVID skepticism and COVID denialism. Why? Because the Republican Party, or at least the MAGA hat wearing wing of the Republican Party, is desperate to get the economy firing on all cylinders before November so that Trump has a chance of reelection. And so for that reason, there's a tremendous amount of what scientists call motivated cognition to believe these COVID denialist stories. Motivated cognition is what David Hume says when he says that reason is a slave of the passions, and where your passions go, so shall your reason go. So I really don't doubt that a lot of the people who are peddling COVID denialism have talked themselves into believing it. Bjorn Lomborg is one of the most prominent climate skeptics, even though he is not a trained scientist in this area, had a Twitter thread the other day just sounding like a flat earther with regards to the mortality rates associated with COVID-19. The same goes for Richard Epstein at Hoover Institute. I mean, it just never ends. And again, I don't really think this is so much a matter of people shilling complete garbage for a paycheck. I think what you've got here are people desperately want to believe a certain narrative. They talk themselves into believing it. And just like in the climate denial world, most of the people who are engaged in this war of denialism have no training in what they're talking about. I mean, they literally have no idea what they're talking about. But they think that they can out-argue the people who spent their whole lives in epidemiology or virology.
In the time in which that was comforting to you, what was it that you found so appealing?
Well, I mean, I was born and bred a libertarian, and so I was highly motivated to find arguments against state action to do X, Y, or Z. And so I fell into that trap of motivated cognition. But one of the things that served me well in the climate skeptic business was just cherry picking data. You know, you focus on one study, which looks like it gives you some anecdotal support for your position, and you ignore the 30 studies that have different outcomes or different findings, or you accept at face value narratives from trusted scientists that utterly misrepresent the mainstream point of view, and you peddle it as if these people are a bunch of crackpot lunatics. And it turns out they're really not. And we see a lot of that right now in the COVID debate. I mean, all of the same sort of dynamics, the misrepresentation of mainstream science, as Amy mentioned, the exploitation of uncertainty. We know a lot of things about climate change, but there's still a wide variance between the lower end and higher end scenarios of future impact. And well, the climate skeptic community feasts off that. Just like in the COVID-19 conversation, there's a lot about the novel coronavirus we just simply don't know. So there's going to be a wide range of estimates out there, and it allows people to exploit them.
We have seen, Jerry, protests around the country, and I guess I wonder for a viewer or someone who's casually observing on the news, how do you parse out who might be a paid actor and who is someone who says, I really want to open my business again?
Well, it's almost, at least as far as the people who are marching in the street or holding signs, entirely the latter and none of the former. Small business owners and individual libertarians and fed up MAGA hat wearing Trumpists and people who are generally outraged over the fact that they can't wade through a sea of dead bodies to get their cup of coffee in the morning. But what's more relevant here is who's organizing this. And it turns out that the same corporate and ideological actors that are underwriting the climate denial movement are largely involved in now trying to put together these sorts of back to work protests. There was a story last week about how a new alliance with the American Legislative Exchange Council and the Heritage Foundation, Club for Growth, and a few other ideological actors that are also involved in climate denialism have now joined together to argue at the state level for immediately reopening the economy and return to normal. So it's not as if when you see somebody holding a sign that you think is spouting nonsense, they're all paid actors who are, you know, doing it for a check. Most of the time, people honestly and legitimately believe what they say. You have to have a little bit of interpretive charity. But organization doesn't happen by itself. That's usually where the more important story is.
Amy, I was wondering if you could sort of explain the term that's called astroturfing and how it fits into this.
So astroturfing is basically fake grassroots activism that is generated or organized by an industry or political group funded kind of organization that is posing as a consumer advocacy or a voter advocacy group, but is actually pushing an agenda for a particular industry or political group. And there are tons of examples of this in the climate space. And now, you know, you're sort of seeing this in the COVID space where protesters are real, but they've been organized and in some cases kind of like ginned up by these groups that have, you know, an agenda that they want to push.
Jerry, I wonder, as a former climate skeptic, what would you say to people who are skeptical of the science behind COVID-19 right now?
One thing I've learned is it's very difficult to tell people that if they believe X, they're wrong and they should believe Z, and here's why. People don't change their mind that easily or that quickly, particularly when they have a lot of motivated cognition behind their point of view. The best that you can do in these cases is to try to open minds, to suggest that they may want to get their news from someplace other than right-wing talk radio or Fox News. I mean, if you inhabit a world in which all of your news information is coming from Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson and Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levine and Alex Jones, it's no wonder they believe what they believe. I mean, think about it. What if all of the things that, you know, say I read, or maybe you read or others that are listening, I read The New Yorker, I read The Atlantic, I read The New York Times, I read The Washington Post, I read Politico. And what would it mean if every single thing I was reading were as dubious and problematic as what right-wing media is, except I had no idea? It's sort of like, what if you were to reverse the question, what would a Fox News viewer want to say to me to try to talk me out of my hysteria with regards to my concern with regards to COVID-19? There's very little they're going to be able to say. The best you can do is ask people to open their minds and open their eyes and look around them and to leave their bubbles, and they'd find that maybe some of the ideas they so quickly dismiss have a little bit more merit to them than they thought.
Jerry Taylor is president of the Niskanen Center, a nonpartisan policy think tank and a former climate skeptic. And Amy Westervelt is the editor-in-chief of Drilled News. The Takeaway is committed to covering climate change all this week as part of a collaboration with hundreds of other media outlets and organizations. This project is called Covering Climate Now, and you can find all our coverage at thetakeaway.org/coveringclimatenow, including from the first climate coverage week back in September.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Welcome back to The Takeaway. On Tuesday, President Trump said he will halt issuing green cards for 60 days, citing high unemployment amid an economic crisis from the COVID-19 pandemic.
By pausing immigration, we'll help put unemployed Americans first in line for jobs as America reopens. So important. It would be wrong and unjust for Americans laid off by the virus to be replaced with new immigrant labor flown in from abroad.
This followed a tweet from Monday night saying he was planning to sign an executive order halting all immigration into the United States. That left experts, analysts, and even some government officials confused and scrambling to try to figure out logistics. As of now, President Trump has seemed to back off that tweet. This is just the latest move by the administration in its attempts to halt people from entering the U.S. In the past few weeks, we've seen travel bans and the near shuttering of the border using the coronavirus pandemic as a justification. So joining us to help us understand all of this is John Washington, a freelance reporter and translator and author of the book The Dispossessed, a story of asylum at the U.S.-Mexican border and beyond. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about this executive order so far? Who would it allow and who would it block from entering the U.S.?
Well, there's plenty that we don't know yet because we haven't actually seen it. So as you mentioned, there was the tweet that came out on Monday night that hinted at some sort of order. And then yesterday, reporting in The Washington Post and elsewhere said that there is an actual order. It is being written. As you just played in that clip, President Trump announced that it is pending and will be coming very shortly. And we think that it's at the Office of Legal Counsel right now, and probably a bunch of lawyers are scrambling to get it out. What it says is that it's basically blocking visas from being processed, more immigration visas from being given out and letting people come into the United States. This comes after a series of measures that have been restricting some form of either travel or immigration. There was first the ban on travel from China, then ban on travel from Europe. There was the closing down of the refugee program. Then there was this order from the CDC to block any travel from coming in on the U.S.-Mexico border. The Canadian border was closed. And asylum is basically shut down at this point. So a whole host of measures have been taken. And you see that Trump is really leveraging, I think, this pandemic to enforce the immigration restrictionist agenda that he has been looking to enforce since he came into office, since even before he came into office.
Do we know yet what this means for green card holders who were sort of already on track to come into the U.S. and where that leaves them?
Well, it very likely leaves them waiting longer. You know, he said that it would be 60 days and then potentially could be suspended. So very likely they will not be able to come within these 60 days at least. It's a long process already, and there are often delays in this kind of thing. So this is unprecedented. There's also the green card that is an adjustment of status for people already living in the United States that have some other sort of immigration status, and they could adjust and get a green card.
Right.
And it wouldn't make any sense at all for them to be stopped from getting that green card, but we will see once we actually see the order.
I want to play you another clip from President Trump's press conference yesterday and see what you have to say. Let's play that.
As we move forward, we'll examine what additional immigration-related measures should be put in place to protect U.S. workers. We want to protect our U.S. workers, and I think as we move forward, we will become more and more protective of them.
So one of the administration's justifications is that this order would, quote, protect the jobs of our great American citizens, saying that migrants essentially take jobs away from people born in the U.S. But economic data generally disputes that claim. What do we know?
You're absolutely right. It does dispute that claim. And, you know, the rhetoric that he's using that is protecting American jobs there's no basis for it. For example, we know that immigrant jobs create more American jobs, that the majority of the immigrants who are coming in on these visas are not taking American jobs whatsoever. They're not jumping any line. They're not getting ahead of the Americans who have been laid off or are not working right now. And we have data that goes even further and is more relevant to this situation. So if you look at, for example, when there's been some serious economic downturns, the Great Depression, at that time, the United States ramped up its deportation of primarily Mexicans and with the Mexican Repatriation Act. And we saw that in areas where more Mexicans were being repatriated or deported, actually U.S. jobs were also lost. So Native employment also went down with the loss of immigrant jobs when they were removed from the country. So there's really no justification for this idea that he's protecting American jobs. And this concept of protection, we've seen it elsewhere in some of these measures that have been taken with the scurrilous claims that people are coming in and infecting the United States or potentially infecting Americans, when actually the opposite is true, that at this point, as we all know, the United States is the epicenter of the pandemic, and U.S. anti-immigration policies are spreading the disease rather than keeping it from coming in.
Well, yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you. Is there any evidence that U.S. immigration policies have helped protect health in the past few weeks? It sounds like you're saying no.
No, there is no evidence, nor is there any evidence that there's any blame to be laid on migrants or refugees for the spread of this virus. This virus was spread initially through business travel, through the flows of global capitalism, through tourism. There's no indication that migration or the movement of refugees or asylum seekers has spread this at all. And yet, we see that a host of countries are shutting down their refugee and asylum processing programs. The United States has been shut down for a while. Even the UN has suspended its refugee resettlement program. For decades, for even centuries, migrants and refugees have been blamed for being vectors of disease. And we know that that is a false flag. We know that it's a very scurrilous claim, and there's no evidence for it.
John, we have seen some other migration restrictions taking place in the past few weeks. What have those been? What have we been seeing, I guess, in the middle of this pandemic? You were talking about some of them.
What's important to just keep in mind here is that while the United States is more than willing to shut down its immigration system when it's taking in migrants and refugees, it hasn't stopped its immigration processing or immigration programs when it's deporting people. Mm. So some of the things that we've seen are, you know, the U.S.-Mexico border and the U.S.-Canadian border are shut down. Then asylum processing is being shut down. We've even been expelling or turning back unaccompanied minors who are coming to the U.S.-Mexico border to ask for protection. We've just been pushing them right back into Mexico. And this very clearly is a violation of both domestic law and international agreements that we have. There is no exemption to the UN Refugee Convention, to which the United States is signatory, nor is there an exemption to the 1980 Refugee Act, which guarantees protection of people who are coming and asking for it.
So yet, what does that mean if you need to request asylum right now?
It's unavailable. So we've shuttered that program, and yet we are deporting people who are currently in the system or expelling them who are trying to access the system. And we know that we have deported dozens of people to Haiti, hundreds of people to various countries in Central America. And we have, at this point, probably near 100 known cases of people being deported with the virus. So in Haiti, for example, there's a few dozen ventilators in the entire country of 11 million people, and we're deporting the virus from the epicenter of the pandemic. The other thing that we can't ignore here is, while we are again suspending our immigration and refugee processing programs, we are not shutting down our immigration detention systems. We've released something around 700 of extremely vulnerable people from ICE detention. There are around 32,000 people currently in ICE detention right now. These, before the pandemic, were absolutely dangerous, medically unsafe locations to be. And now, with the pandemic, they are, you know, potentially hotbeds for an absolute scourge. I spoke with a man just the other day in a detention center in Louisiana. He's in a barrack, in a unit with 100 other people all in the same room. There's no possibility for social distancing. The guards come in and out from the outside. Some of them don't wear masks, and they went a day without having soap. They had no access to soap for a day. That same detention center had already seen some cases. So there are over 200 at this point confirmed cases of the contagion in ICE detention centers. That number is far likely much higher, and we are very likely, unfortunately, going to see that number go way up and people get sick and potentially die.
John Washington is a freelance reporter and translator and author of the book The Dispossessed, a story of asylum at the U.S.-Mexican border and beyond, available now from Verso Books. John, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Good evening. A unique day in American history is ending, a day set aside for a nationwide outpouring of mankind seeking its own survival. Earth Day, a day dedicated to enlisting all the citizens of a bountiful country in the common cause of saving life from the deadly byproducts of that bounty, the fouled skies, the filthy waters, the littered earth.
Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970. That's Walter Cronkite, by the way. That unique day began as a great environmental teach-in.
A teach-in was a tactic that the anti-Vietnam War movement used in the mid-1960s.
That's Adam Rome, environmental historian at the University at Buffalo and author of The Genius of Earth Day, how a 1970 teach-in unexpectedly made the first green generation.
It was kind of extracurricular, politically charged discussion between opponents of the war and supporters of the war. And the founder of Earth Day, Gaylord Nelson, heard about that. He'd been trying to find ways of making the environment a national priority, and he thought if Americans would just stop and really think about pollution and all the other problems, environmental problems of the day, that would move them to act. So he vowed to create a nationwide environmental teach-in in spring 1970, and that became Earth Day.
But Gaylord Nelson, Democratic senator from Wisconsin, didn't go in with a roadmap for that day.
When he made that promise, he had no idea how he was going to do it. The advice he got was to have a very top-down, hierarchical thing where he would pick schools and he'd pick the organizers and he'd suggest the agenda. And I think his genius was to reject that advice. So essentially, he let anyone who wanted to have a teach-in or an Earth Day, as it came to be called, and they could do anything they wanted. Originally, his own staff at the end of 1969, tried to help all the people that wrote saying, I'd love to do this. You got any ideas? But he quickly realized he was going to be overwhelmed. His staff would be overwhelmed. So he hired Dennis Hayes to help run Environmental Teach-In, Inc., a not-for-profit. And then Dennis hired a bunch of other young 20-something 60s activists. In my view, at least, they became the PR firm for Earth Day. And they were the ones that named it Earth Day. They asked, they got an offer from a hip ad guy in New York, and they didn't like the name Teach-In, and he suggested Earth Day, and they took out a full-page ad in the New York Times that said Earth Day in the biggest print I've ever seen in the newspaper. And that was amazing.
Well, I grew up in a paper milling community where there were no pollution controls on it.
This is Dennis Hayes, a national organizer of the first Earth Day in 1970.
So I woke up every morning for the first 18 years of my life with a sore throat from sulfur dioxide and hydrogen sulfide, which also destroyed the roofs of our houses and pitted our automobiles. They poured sludge out into the Columbia River, and I'd walk down there and see thousands of dead fish. They clear-cut the surrounding forests. I have to confess, as I was growing up, that seemed normal. That's how it was. And when I complained a bit about the smell, because when we visited people in other towns, they said, it's a place that stinks, isn't it? My dad patiently explained to me that that's the smell of prosperity. But as I grew older and older, I came to think, geez, it must be possible to make paper without destroying the world. And then to similarly take that same attitude, it must be possible to make electricity. It must be possible to make steel. It must be possible to build a modern industrial society without this kind of ecological damage.
Dennis was a young graduate student when Senator Nelson gave him a job organizing the first Earth Day.
You know, we had planned Earth Day 1970 as one of the major events like the March on the Pentagon, the Poor People's March, the March in Selma. It was to be a one-time event to crystallize an issue and bring it dramatically to the attention of public officials.
When the day came, Dennis got his first true glimpse of its scale and resonance.
Well, I flew off to New York City, where Mayor John Lindsay had given us basically Fifth Avenue. He blocked off the intersections for more than 50 blocks of Fifth Avenue, and we filled it with environmentalists. Climbed up on a platform that was 5 or 6 stories tall, looked out on this sea of people where you simply couldn't see the edge, the people like the ocean extended over the horizon.
For 2 hours, fashionable Fifth Avenue was off limit to automobiles and became a crowded pedestrian mall. The square hadn't looked this clean in years, with volunteer help doing the sprucing up.
What we really face is not air or water pollution, but the pollution of life itself.
And that was probably the most dramatic, one of the most dramatic moments of my life, and certainly of that day when we realized it wasn't just big, but it was truly enormous.
Ultimately, the day grew to well beyond what Senator Nelson and Dennis had dreamed.
In the end, it turned out to be massive. 20 million people participated. Roughly 1 out of every 10 Americans took part in Earth Day. And it raised all of these issues about the way that our national health, our national environmental well-being, our standard of living were all becoming poorer as the gross domestic product got richer.
In many cases, it wasn't just one day. It was a whole week, and it sometimes had a theme. Birmingham, Alabama had Right to Live Week. They were really concerned about air pollution there. You know, Madison, Wisconsin had Lifestyle on Trial. That was all about our consumer culture. Tens of thousands of people organized those local events.
Well, environmental issues have been treated sort of like a pendulum in politics. We have 10 good years, 10 bad years, 10 good years, 10 bad years. And interestingly, Earth Day, of course, has evolved with it. When you have a period of great environmental advancements, we have these celebratory events. And when you have a period when they're rolling back our progress, we have these protest demonstrations and marches and things. It evolves to meet the needs of the time. Earth Day 2020, at a personal level, will be the quietest Earth Day that I have had in 50 years. We do lose something as we move into an entirely virtual event. You can have 5 million people watching speeches and videos and animations on their computers, and it just doesn't have the same kind of impact of having 750,000 people at a rally in the National Mall facing the Capitol and screaming at the White House. It's just different kinds of events. But I will say that the generation that is going to be mostly fighting these battles, the younger Americans and younger people around the world, are digital natives. They already spend a lot of time on their computers. They are comfortable in that environment and will be receptive to messages from scientists, from celebrities, from the Pope, from other religious leaders, and it will not be a total loss. If COVID-19 had hit in 1970, when a small computer would be a Cyber 76, it still requires its own cooling system and its own independent room, and it only has about 12 other computers in the country to talk to, COVID-19 would have killed Earth Day in 1970. It's a really important speed bump in 2020.
For me, you know, it's easy sometimes to despair about the future, but whenever I get in that mood, thinking about Earth Day is an antidote. We came together, millions of people, not just on one day, but for years and decades afterward. And that really made a difference, and we could do it again.
Adam Rome is environmental historian at the University at Buffalo and author of The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. And Dennis Hayes is a founding organizer of Earth Day in 1970 and president and CEO of the Bullitt Foundation. And you can see streaming Earth Day events at earthday.org. All right, that's it for us today. Happy Earth Day, and thanks for listening. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, comparing car insurance rates from multiple insurers so shoppers can evaluate options in one place. Now that's Progressive. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.